And in case you don't know what you're doing, you're listening to Red Eyes Radio. We cover many different subjects, and of course you can listen whenever you want, stream or download. You can also subscribe to our RSS feeds. You can find more information on redeyescreations.com. And for our full archives, check out redeyesmembers.com. We have much more available for our subscribers. Seth Farber is a writer, social critic, dissident psychologist, activist and co-founder of the Network Against Coercive Psychiatry. His newest book is called The Spiritual Gift of Madness, The Failure of Psychiatry, and The Rise of the Mad Pride Movement. We also have Paul Levy with us in the first hour. He studied economics and art, and he's the author of The Madness of George Bush, A Reflection of Our Collective Psychosis, as well as Wetiko, The Greatest Epidemic Sickness Known to Humanity. Seth and Paul will talk about how the psychiatric system is limited to the five senses, misdiagnosing spiritual experiences and shamanic awakenings as pathological. Paul shares his experience of psychiatric treatment, and Seth talks about the problems within the psychiatric field. All right, welcome to Red Eyes Radio, Seth. Thank you for coming on the program, first of all. Really appreciate it. This is going to be interesting. How are you today?
Fine, thanks, Heinrich.
Good to talk to you. And then we have Paul Levy with us as well. Hi, Paul. It's good to have you back again on the program. Welcome.
Yeah, it's so great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you, guys. This is going to be interesting. We have a lot to discuss, and we're obviously going to focus around the new book, Seth. And before we kind of hear a little bit more about Paul's story and get to Paul, maybe you can set the kind of the background a little bit for us, Seth, and tell us, I guess, your journey into this field, and then we can get into the specifics about the book. So go ahead, Seth.
Well, I started off, I decided to become a psychologist back in 1976, and I didn't realize how profoundly corrupt the whole mental health field was, confused, ignorant. So naively I went into the field and thought I could, I didn't have any idea of how the field related to the crisis of humanity, nor that things would be getting worse, both in the field and in world at large. However, by the time I finished in 1984 my PhD, I had become disillusioned with Freudianism. At that time, psychoanalysis, as it was called, was the dominant paradigm. At any clinic you went into, in any university program in psychology, the model they taught was psychoanalysis, which meant that, and I became very critical of it, because it meant that everything that would happen in your life was determined by, everything that would happen as an adult was determined by the time you were 2 or 3 or 4 years old. And so one group that was most biased against by the mental health profession, by the group that Thomas Szasz, who wrote, the psychiatrist who wrote the book, The Forward of Mental, The Myth of Mental Illness, was what he called the psychiatric priesthood with schizophrenics. And those, and then Paul was labeled bipolar psychotic. Now, he would be in the group that at that time, we could talk about how it is now, but was considered hopeless, a hopeless, incurable case, incurable, these people. So this was what was drilled into me in psychology, that these were a group of individuals that needed to be under supervision of psychiatrists their whole life, that could never accomplish anything in life, and that their main goal should be just to stay out of a mental hospital, because they were in danger of what the mental health establishment called decompensating, which means having a breakdown at any time. And I ended up, even in the beginning, I had a fascination with those people called schizophrenics or they didn't have the term bipolar then, manic depression, depressive would have been called by those people, because I felt that they had some special gift, that was something special about them, and I didn't believe the ordinary the party line in the field about it. Of course, the party line was to change somewhat when the drug companies got a hold of the psychiatric profession and took control, and then the ideology switched, but still the main victims were the schizophrenics and the bipolars, who were really the cast of untouchables, comparable to the untouchables in India. So by the time I graduated, I was meaning getting my PhD, I was skeptical of the whole thing. And I think a turning point was I moved to New York to study family therapy with some people like Jay Haley, who didn't believe that schizophrenia was a chronic mental illness. And I had also read Julian Silverman, who compared schizophrenics in an article in the American Anthropologist to shamans. Now, this was new to me when I read this. And one of my clients in a place in New Jersey where I taught, where I practiced family therapy, a guy, we'll call him John, was told that he was a schizophrenic, that he could never live a normal life, that he'd have to be on these drugs. And the drugs they put them on, the antipsychotics, as they call them, were the worst drugs. They were designed, they introduced them into mental hospitals, these drugs, when they were discovered. A whole mythology developed around them. But in actuality, when they introduced them, the guy who discovered the drug, Laborat, a French guy, said, we have a chemical substitute for a lobotomy. That was meant as a compliment at the time. Because they were beginning to be ambivalent about lobotomies because of the negative effects, but they thought a chemical lobotomy was good. And one good thing was it turned people into zombies, which was good for them. So I had this client who was so-called mentally ill, and I told him, well, you're not mentally ill. By that point, I had developed my own theory that people called mentally ill were having a spiritual breakthrough in most cases, and that the drugs prevented them from completing the breakthrough, and there's some evidence for this. And he told me that he heard voices. So of course this was the main symptom of schizophrenia, if you hear voices. Of course now they have hearing voices networks all over the world, but they're particularly big in Europe, I think, and they're starting in America. And people have been saying for a number of years now, hearing voices is not a sign of schizophrenia. The people in the Bible, the great people throughout here, from Socrates, had heard a voice that gave him guidance. And I told that to John. I told him, your problem is not you're hearing your voice. So you're getting yourself in trouble, John, because you're taking the voice as God. It's not the voice of God. It's perhaps the voice of a spirit that's come to give you guidance, but you have to make your own decisions. And I encourage him to get off, as I encourage everybody to get off the so-called antipsychotics, because I believe they're really anti-spiritual drugs. They destroy spirituality. Yep. They cause tardive dyskinesia. And he was trying to get off. I brought in his parents to try to convince them that he didn't have a quote-unquote schizophrenia, but instead they were infuriated and tried to get me fired from the clinic and threatened to sue the clinic. And eventually I did get fired. By the way, when I tell people to get off the drugs, I tell them to do it gradually because the drugs are as addictive as heroin.
Sure, yeah.
I did get fired, and I kept calling John. Well, I didn't know what happened to him, but 10 years later, because his mother would hang up the phone on me, but he's just one example. 10 years later, he called me, and he'd been off the drugs for 10 years because of my intervention, which was not any rocket science. I didn't do anything brilliant. I just conveyed my faith in him to him.
Mm-hmm.
I conveyed to him that I didn't think he was a schizophrenic. I don't believe anyone is a schizophrenic. Because of that, he got the drugs, got off the drugs and was able to lead a normal life. And he had told me before he left about a meeting that was taking place. I went to this meeting, and then I met some of the leaders in the Mental Patients Liberation Movement, which I had never heard from before, heard of before. And then I discovered that there was a couple thousand people who were told they were chronically mentally ill and were all off the drugs and were some of the most extraordinary people I met in my life. So that was the beginning of my career as a heretic within the mental health profession.
Very good. I mean, obviously, the title, The Spiritual Gift of Madness, The Failure of Psychiatry and the Rise of the Mad Pride Movement. Is there anything else you want to say or can't say about the Mad Pride movement so people know a little bit more what it is, Seth?
Well, yeah, the Mad Pride movement was a term that didn't come into existence until 1999 when a group in Britain decided they'd call themselves Mad Pride. It was very controversial at the time. This movement started in 1970 in Portland, I believe, was the first group. It was amazing because it was then called the Mental Patients Liberation Movement. And in the late 80s, they changed it to the Psychiatric Survivors Movement. It was amazing. As soon as this group started, there were all kinds of people who would have spent their whole lives in mental hospitals who then became political activists and said that they were victims of treatment in psychiatric hospitals. So it began in 70 and it went through various changes. And I believe that the most important change was when it became the Mad Pride movement. And I believe that it has yet to fulfill its potential. I think someone like Paul, who's not actually active in the Mad Pride movement, but I think he represents the future of the Mad Pride movement, because it's my belief that the people who are labeled schizophrenics are actually the visionaries of the species, that you have more people in of that group called schizophrenics. There are more, if you take them and bipolar, you have more people who have had spiritual experiences, who've had visions of how the world should be, could be, visions of harmony, a peace, of a world transformed, messianic visions, than any other group I've ever met. So when they made the shift from the Mental Patients Liberation Movement to the Mad Pride Movement, they made the shift from what I call a Thomas Zazian view of themselves as victims of psychiatry, which is somewhat true, mm-hmm. but to what I call a Langian, R.D. Langian view, which is emphasizing what it was that led them to be singled out by psychiatry in the first place, which I believe was their spirituality, their visions, because we live in a materialistic society, and materialistic both in the philosophical sense of looking at the world as a scientifically, it's just not having any, to quote Max Weber, of a disenchanted cosmos. It's been
right.
In which God has been, to quote Nietzsche, God has been killed.
Yeah.
So a cosmos without any mystery, and the schizophrenics, so-called schizophrenics, were having mystical experiences, and so when we go from Mental Patients Liberation to Mad Pride, then you get someone like Paul Levy, and he represents the future. The purpose, I think, all of the movement was to help other people to become the kind of catalyst of messianic change as Paul is today.
You raise some very interesting points here that we should detail and discuss further, Seth. But I think to set the stage and again give people a clear example of some of the problems that you've been describing so far, I think we should turn our attention to Paul and hear your story, Paul, and you can describe to us what happened to you, how you were perceived, I guess, and also how you kind of got yourself out of this, Paul.
Sure. Yeah. So, to say it in simple terms, I was having this life-changing spiritual awakening in 1981, and right away I got in the clutches of psychiatry, and they almost killed me. I mean, it literally destroyed my family. I have no family left. Both my parents died, convinced, you know, that I have a mental illness and that I would have this illness, you know, for the rest of my life. And so it's been, you know, it happened in 81, and I'm still, it's the trauma and the torture of what I had to go through. I'm still trying, I mean, even though it's 30 some odd years, I'm still trying to integrate just the horror of what played out. But if I can just create context, so what preceded the awakening was just, I'm an only child, and my father was a very sick man, and I was the recipient of his acting out of his shadow and his abuse. And how come I bring that in is because quite often there's a correlation between having being either a victim of abuse or trauma or having, like, you know, wound, getting, you know, having like this wounding experience and shamanic initiation or spiritual awakening. Somehow, once we get traumatized, that almost sets in motion in the psyche this deeper archetypal process of awakening. And so that's what was happening for me right before the awakening in May 1981. I was an unbelievably deep suffering as a result of the abuse with my father. So I was going into it. I was just, the only thing I could figure out that helped was meditation, and was just to really just step back and to watch what was happening, because I quickly figured out that I couldn't figure my way out of my process with my mind. So I just was doing that, you know, and I had a teacher, and I was doing it hours and hours a day, and then one day I got hit by a bolt of lightning, but not from the sky. It just ignited inside of my brain. And within 24 hours, I went into such an expansive state, and where it was like I stepped out of my typical conditioned, repressed self, and was really connecting with this way more expansive identity, where I was recognizing my interconnectedness, my interdependence with everyone. I was recognizing that we're having a mass shared dream. And so I was in this ecstatic state, you know, so I wasn't just in stasis being stuck. I had really stepped out of my sense of feeling double bound. But I was with a friend who was, you know, scared, because all of a sudden I had stepped out of the typical identity pattern that I was typically inhabit.
Yeah.
So he brought me by ambulance to a hospital. This is Highland Hospital, Oakland, California, May in 81. And so if I can just tell the first story, just to give you a sense of when I say I was having a spiritual awakening, well, here's an example. So I get brought in by the ambulance to the psych ward at Highland Hospital. They bring me into this room, and it's where all the psychiatric patients are just hanging out. And I see this blind woman, and without any thinking on my part, I just feel drawn to her, and I go up to her, and her eyes are totally opaque, like a blind person's eyes. You know, it's really obvious. And as if I was given these lines to say, as if I had a script, as I got up to her and I just was staring at her eyes, I began saying these words that just fell into my head, and the words were, "All you have to do to see is open your eyes and look." All you have to do to see is open your eyes and look. And I kept on saying that over and over, and I was getting closer and closer to her as I kept on staring at her eyes. The whole thing took probably a minute, and by the end of that minute, her sight was restored. All of a sudden, her blind eyes just completely became radiant and luminous, and she was able to see. And at that moment, as if it was like a choreographed play, they took me and they brought me into this other room, and they actually strapped me up onto a bed, and they gave me pills to take, which I'm assuming were some form of antipsychotic or something. And so that's where I spent the night, you know, strapped up on that bed. And just to give you a sense, I mean, it certainly wasn't your, you know, like a typical night's sleep. Here I was totally aware. I was having a spiritual awakening. I began thinking or feeling like, wow, anybody that I was thinking of or even feeling or just, you know, just having, just thinking about, I was imagining I could bring them along on the awakening. So I began thinking about more and more people who I knew, mm-hmm. till I, you know, just kept on expanding the circle, and that, and it got to the point that it included everyone, and I was just imagining that everyone was awakening and was coming along. And then what happened, just to complete this story, the next morning they unstrapped me, and they put me in a room, and the only other person in the room is this woman who was, you know, who now could see but was blind. She's sitting at a table right across from me, and she's smiling at me ear to ear. And then all of a sudden my heart chakra, I had never had this experience before, it just blossomed, and I understood what had happened the day, you know, that night before, that, oh, I get it, her eyes were, from the physical dimension, were fine, but it was almost like in the inner, the psychic part of her was not looking at something, and that was manifesting as her blindness, and somehow I was, you know, able to see that or just tune into that, and that she was at the point in her process of being able to heal her blindness, and I was the one sent in a way to play the role, and I said my lines, helping her to wake up, or helping her to heal her blindness. And so then she says to me, so I had that realization sitting across from her, then she says to me, at that point, the only word she'd ever said to me, she goes, aren't you going to answer the phone call? And she says my father's name from, you know, so-and-so.
Mm-hmm.
And all of, you know, within 10 seconds, in walks the nurse and says, Paul, your father is on the phone, because my parents had just found out that I had supposedly this psychotic break. And so I got out of that hospital after 3 days because the doctor convinced me I had to prove to him that I wasn't, you know, just totally mentally ill. And I heard that, you know, I didn't want to, I mean, I was perfectly fine staying there because I had so surrendered to what was happening in the moment. But then when I reflected upon, wow, you know, he wants to keep me here for a really long time, or I can, like, just show him that I'm not crazy. So I just, you know, completely became normal and began talking about my problems and my father and this and that. And he said to me, fine, you can go.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually got together the next week over a meal, and I told him about what had happened with the blind woman, and he got incredibly uncomfortable. And he says, oh, I can't talk about that. There's patient confidentiality. But he did say to me, how come he let me out? Was because I was able to fluidly step into, you know, just my typical identity, where somebody who was really supposedly, you know, crazy would not have that fluidity between the identity states like that.
Yeah. Wow, it's an incredible story. And so how were you treated by the, I mean, what happened after this? How were you treated by the system? Were you beginning to go on medication? And how did that affect you?
Right. No, that's a perfect question, because what happened, so here I had tapped into something, and it was like I was the 75-watt bulb that had tapped into like a trillion watts, and I was out in the world. I wasn't in a container. I wasn't in like an ashram or anything like that.
Right.
So during that, you know, in the next 18 months or something like that, I probably was hospitalized 3 or 4 other times, and each time I would always get diagnosed as, oh, you're bipolar. At that point, it wasn't called bipolar. And they guaranteed me that I would have this illness for the rest of my life. And when somebody's, you know, having an awakening like that, you're in such a vulnerable, transparent, like this fragile state in a way, because your whole inner constitution is being sort of dissolved so as to be like re-engineered or reconstituted from within. So you're in a very open state. So basically what I'm saying is that the experience with psychiatry, they kept on concretizing me as being mentally ill, pathologizing me, whenever I would just phenomenologically talk about what I was experiencing, that would even prove to them even more how crazy I was. And then the fact that I would want to question their diagnosis or even not agree with their diagnosis was more proof to them of my mental illness. So it was like I had gotten into this diabolical, this negative, like this, it was like a feedback loop, that whenever I was just being myself or expressing my experience, that was confirmation to the psychiatrist of my illness. And so basically what happened in that scenario, as soon as they had power over me, once I was in the hospital, I got sicker and sicker. And so the whole spiritual, the part of my process that was like awakening, more and more went into the background, and all of a sudden more and more all the abuse came out from my father. And as I was trying to describe that, then I would just get pathologized for that. So it was just, it was a horror. And then by the final hospitalization, that next year, I was given this completely concretized diagnosis. I was going to have to be on medication for the rest of my life. And all of my friends and my family, they all bought into it. It just destroyed it. I mean, it literally just consumed my family. Like I said, both my parents died having subscribed to the psychiatric point of view. And I mean, it was, and I'm only barely touching on the horror of what that was like. And it's not just my experience. I mean, so many people, I think, are having forms of spiritual awakening and are getting pathologized and just shut down by the psychiatric system.
So you were drawn through your experiences with your father and all that. But that's something that actually did you think helped you in any way at the end, or should this not have been drawn up in this way again in the psychiatrist setting? What do you think, Paul?
Wait, could you? I'm not quite sure of the question. So could you clarify what you're saying?
Sure.
What was potentially helpful?
Considering that you were drawn through, as you said, your experiences with your father again, with the when you were in the with the psychiatrist and everything, right? You were on medication, and they were going through, and they basically tried to pinpoint that. Okay, this is the reason for your problem, so we need to analyze this. Correct. So at the end of it, coming out of this as you are today, do you feel that was helpful in any way, or should they have stayed away from that altogether?
Yeah, no, that's such a great question, because basically, from one point of view, I was having a spiritual awakening, and psychiatrists came in and totally just shut it down. And that's true from one point of view, and a part of me, even current day, is just so angry about that. But over the course of time, I've begun to reframe it as like, oh, that was part of my awakening, getting, kind of institutionalized in the psychiatric system. And that was almost like some sort of like a shamanic sort of descent into the underworld. And that's a whole other perspective that over the course of time that I really am able to hold and see that there's real truth in that. And the thing which was interesting is that what played out in psychiatry was, it was like an iteration of the same fractal that had played out with my father, where it was all in the name of, oh, we just want to help you, and it's all for your own good, and we just have this love for you. And but meanwhile, I was totally treated, my experiences and perceptions by both my father and psychiatry were I was treated as an invalid. They were invalidated. I didn't have a voice so the whole thing I'm saying is that it was interesting that iteration of a fractal that played out with psychiatry and my father, that they both were in sort of acting out their unconscious shadow in a way that was filled with abuse, but all, they had their intention was, oh, we're doing this for your own good. And so that actually helped me when over the course of time when I saw, because that could be re-traumatizing, but I also saw, oh, wow, there's a deeper process that was informing not only my father and the psychiatric community, but the whole field of consciousness, that something was actually being shown to me through all of these events with my father in psychiatry, that I was actually going through some form of like an initiatory ordeal. And as soon as I began to see that and deepen that, that's exactly what began to unfold. So it actually did have some benefits, what I went through, but it was only because of what I was able to do with it based on my own inner work and my own awareness.
Yeah. Now, let's talk a little bit about why this has happened and how it has happened. Because if it is true, Seth, as you suggested earlier, that let's say people from our past was guided by spiritual voices, shall we say, they're tapping into something. And again, some people have called these shamans or even witch doctors, if I can use that word. And there could be something, there's something behind this. It's a bigger agenda, I think, going on here. And I want to talk with you a little bit why the reasons why this has happened, because if we can call it a suppression of sorts of both schizophrenics and others who are having this spiritual experience that Paul explains. They're hearing voices and being guided in other ways. What do you think of the reasons why this has been suppressed in the larger context within society then? Is it simply because People don't want to take responsibility. They don't want to be faced by these problems. They're busy. They want to have other things to do. So let's just do the modern version of lobotomization, which is to medicate, as you said before. Or is there a bigger agenda at work here of why these voices should be silenced? What do you think, Seth?
Psychiatrists seem to be the spiritually the most backward segment of the population. I mean, if you were to, having worked in the field, I mean, in America, you know, they've done polls and stuff, and people have had psychic experiences, and a large percentage of the population, and large, the background of America's coming, religious dissidents, who many of whom fled Europe, it's, America's always been known as a more religious country, and then there are bad aspects of it too, than Europe. But psychiatrists don't see that way. For some reason, they are the most materialistic in the sense of, spirituality being viewed. Virtually all my colleagues, this was in the 70s and 80s, you had no doubt that hearing voice was a sign of mental illness. So it had to do with the world view, at least largely at that point. At this point, there's an economic factor in it in terms of the drug companies.
Sure.
That has to do with their world view. They are not capable of seeing, for example, when I said to a group of, when I first met people in the mental patients liberation movement, I said that yesterday's shaman is today's chronic schizophrenic.
Yeah.
And they understood that completely, because they had had, once I described to them what a shaman was like, they'd all had experiences like that. These are people labeled schizophrenic, but from the psychiatric viewpoint, they are the priesthood, but the religion is materialism. There's nothing beyond what we can, the five senses. To have a mystical experience is already a sign of pathology, a sign of mental illness. But back in the beginning of this century, the psychiatrists started writing psychological biographies of Jesus Christ. Actually, there was one written more recently that I quote in one of my books. A psychiatrist who said it was unfortunate that modern psychiatry wasn't there at the time of Jesus, because it might have been able to help Jesus, and he would have been able to return to his career as a carpenter. So their idea of what mental health is working at the 9-to-5 job, not having any experience of anything beyond the five senses, and so that any kind of paranormal experience is immediately defined as pathology, and the effort to come, Artie Lang called them mind police, and so the effort becomes to suppress these experiences and terrify psychiatrists. They live in their own dream world of a kind of Newtonian view of the world, in which predates Einstein or quantum mechanics in terms of its view of the world. And so anything that goes beyond that, and here are these people who like so-called schizophrenic, who are having all kinds of spiritual experiences that are, in most cases, are overwhelming them. They never heard of it before, and they're frightened if they have a vision of the universe as the playground of God, or any of it, because they're not prepared for it by the American materialist worldview, the things that are taught generally throughout colleges and schools, and so I believe that they are, in that sense, they were. And now the whole thing is, since they merged with the drug companies, the financial motive seems to be dominant. But I believe for a long time, having accepted the Freudian worldview, and they regard religion as a neurosis.
Yeah.
And so they regarded religious experiences as neurotic, as psychotic. And,
could I just say something? Could I jump
sure.
in here for a second?
Sure, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, because what Seth is saying is so right on, because a real part of the experience that I was having, I mean, I just shared one experience, and there were so many of experiences like those, but the underlying sort of whatever the experience that I was really tapping into was that, oh, well, we are the Messiah, all of us. Here's this world, and it's actually waking up through us. Like, we're the instrument through which, in a way, God becomes aware of itself. And we can actually, what I call conspire to co-inspire, to help each other to bring that realization in. And, you know, I have a ton of different ways of creatively articulating this insight, and I was trying to, in my own way, this is so long ago, trying to creatively express what I was realizing, and it's typical, because it was so new for me, and I was just like in my mid-20s, I was a kid, you know, I hadn't developed a skillfulness, or I hadn't, you know, fully integrated what I was trying to say, so... You know, and I also didn't understand I shouldn't really be saying this stuff to people who are psychiatrists who are trained to pathologize. But I think what I'm articulating is sort of a common occurrence to so many people who are actually beginning to awaken, snapping out of the limited identity that we've all been hypnotized into imagining that we are, and who are actually tuning into a more expansive identity and recognizing the dreamlike nature, the interconnection, the interdependence that we all have. That's like a sort of an archetypal experience that so many people have, and it has to do with seeing, oh my God, we can help each other to wake up. And unfortunately, then in walks psychiatry, who in a way are the instruments, when you see the deeper process, they're the instruments, you know, who kind of like shut down that energy because they just want to create people who are so-called like these normal people who
right.
don't have any sort of, you know, off the radar experiences type of thing, and it's tragic. It really is.
They are creating sameness in society. There is no diversity
totally.
Anymore, and it's incredible how when people don't fit into this mold, something has to be wrong with them. Either it's going to be physical or it's going to be psychological. In that sense, they see it upon themselves that it's their role to fix this, right? So they become
the thing I didn't even understand when I had my awakening was in 81, and I learned a little while ago that the DSM-3 had just come out in 1980, which was the DSM that actually said,
okay,
the psychiatric Bible, which said, oh, we've now discovered there's a chemical imbalance. So that had just been discovered the year before I had my experience, and every psychiatrist was telling me, and I was astonished, going, well, Paul, you have this chemical imbalance. And I was boggled. I was saying, no, I don't have a chemical imbalance. That's absurd. And I didn't have the context for, oh, yeah, they had just been indoctrinated in their Bible. It had just come out that previous year, this new discovery about a chemical imbalance.
So that's really interesting. There are many more things I want to ask you as well about this in regards to your experiences then, Paul, because we might, in this regard, have access to you then as a person who have gone through something similar as to those people from our past. And let's say it's always easier to have a view of them than it is to have it with the people around us everyday life, right? Because they're
sure.
considered to be more historically important people, if you know what I mean. But in different
right, right.
ways, they've reformed society because of their experiences and their messages. So describe, if you can, a little bit more what you went through. I mean, if we take this example again of what you told the blind woman, for example, what were you
sure.
tapping into there? What did that feel like? What was that?
Yeah, well, okay. Keep in mind, part of the experience, too, so during that time, I was in and out of mental hospitals, and I was also getting to meet these people who were my teachers from Burma and Tibet, some of the greatest of the enlightened teachers in the world. I was connecting with them and becoming really close with them and hanging out at their monasteries. And so the experience that I was having was I was basically, stuff began happening in my life. Like I told the one story about the blind woman, that was still a physically possible event because that was just sort of an auspicious coincidence of factors, like a synchronistic happening that was very improbable, but it still could potentially happen. But then there began happening so many things that were physically impossible that could only happen in a dream. And it's those experiences that I've learned not to talk about because, you know, certain experiences you just don't really, you know, talk about openly. But the point is that something was, it was like I was having these overwhelming experiences that were showing me this was a dream that we were all having. We were, it was like all of us are collectively having a shared dream. And I was seeing that. I was beginning to actually understand that, or that was like not just an intellectual insight. It was my experience. And then my experiences in the world were like actually reflecting that back, in that these miracle things would happen that were physically impossible, that could only happen in dreams. And they typically would happen when I was around these enlightened beings. And I would then describe phenomenologically the exact same experiences that I was having, that I had been telling the psychiatrist, in which I'd gotten pathologized, and then I would be telling my teachers, and they would be like, oh, that's great. You're beginning to remember who you are. You're beginning to wake up and all that. Mm-hmm. So I found that really interesting, that the exact same experiences were interpreted totally in polar opposite ways, depending on who I spoke with. And I guess one final thing I want to say, what really got me through, because, I mean, I can't even begin to articulate how, you know, the actual, it felt like torture, but the abuse from the psychiatrist really trying to drill in my head that I'm mentally ill and I need to accept it and I need to step out of denial and all those things. And the only thing that saved me was that my inner subjective experience, I was so clear I was having an awakening. It wasn't even, you know, when you have an experience like with that blind woman, that's a pretty crystal clear experience to reflect upon. And I was having so many experiences like that. So I just never lost touch, thankfully, that no, they're just out of their mind. They're just projecting their own insanity. They're just projecting their own, like, you know, shadow onto me. And that I just need to stay for and stand for my own experience. And very quickly, within, you know, when I got out of that last hospital, I actually connected with a psychiatrist and worked with her for a few years. But then, you know, I mean, but very quickly I got off any medication. I haven't been on medication for, like, I don't know, since probably 83 or something like mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, so then I just quickly, you know, continued hopefully unfolding my awakening as soon as I extricated myself from the psychiatric system.
Yeah, one thing that Paul said is very typical. He said he didn't. The psychiatrist wouldn't let him go until they felt he had insight. Over and over and over again, the psychiatrist will tell the patient, "You don't have insight." And what insight means is saying, "Yes, I realize that what is that I have a mental illness." So if Paul would say, well, I'm having a spiritual kind of experience, that means he doesn't have insight. So insight means saying, in psychiatry, they will badger the patient over and over again. And they actually believe this is their delusional system, that insight means the patient says, I have a mental illness. I'm going to take my drug, and if the right. medication, and if they do that well enough, they actually will be able to get the psychiatrist to say, ah, you're doing better, and to get out of the system. But if they keep saying, no, I believe in my vision, I believe
right.
what's
right.
happened to me, St. Paul said, if I believe that I saw Jesus on the way to Damascus. That way, you never get out of the mental hospital.
They'll keep you in there forever.
What Seth is saying is so totally true, in the sense that the treatment from that I received, you know, a personal experience in psychiatry, is that if I signed on and subscribed to their point of view, i.e. that I was mentally ill, that was considered a successful treatment. Mm-hmm. And I just remember, as Seth was talking, there was an image that came up. There was one hospital I was in, and I was in there for a number of weeks, I think 3 weeks, and they brought me in at a certain point to a conference room with all the psychiatrists who had been having a conference about me. And then so there was me, just imagine the image, and then, you know, all the psychiatrists in the ward, and they presented to me that, yes, they're all in agreement that I have this mental illness, I'll have it for the rest of my life, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I actually said to them, no, that's totally wrong. You have no idea what you're talking about, which, of course, just confirmed to them, you know, my illness. And the thing which is weird, I want to point out something about the spell casting that goes on in psychiatry, because, you know, the person, like I was saying, the patient is in such an open state. When you get pathologized, it actually invokes you to become sick. You're actually, you know, when somebody's seeing you and solidifying you, particularly when they're in the role of power and seeing you as being, you know, mentally ill, then it's actually making you sick, and then you manifest in a way that's not fully whole, and then they have even more evidence to prove to them the seeming correctness of their viewpoint, so they become even more entrenched in their fixed viewpoint of seeing you as ill. That's the feedback loop I was trying to describe before, and it's exactly like not only are they casting a spell, but they're actually under a spell at the same time.
Right, right. Well, it's very interesting. I mean, it's funny in one regard, because it's about them understanding an individual experience that you're having, you know, internally in that sense. And what if you even can't express certain things verbally because of the things that you're going through, and yet they're sitting on the outside, literally, of this and trying to diagnose you at the same time. So what this means is that there is no infrastructure, if I can put it that way, for having a spiritual experience, at least in the Western world, Paul.
Yeah, and the thing was that my perceptions weren't counted at all as part of my treatment. I was just considered to be mentally ill and invalid. I was just pushed to the margins, and they just had this like grimoire, the DSM, the psychiatric Bible, trying to read in that any words that matched what I was saying I was experiencing, trying to figure out, oh, what my pathology is. I mean, the whole thing was so incredibly nuts. And one of the things that's most difficult is that a person who's in the role of the patient, they don't have any power.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, all the power is, you know, and the privilege and this, you know, whatever, just the position of having, like, rank is like, you know, in the hands of the psychiatrist. And to the extent that they treat you as an object and they're not actually in like a relationship with you,
yeah,
they're actually unwittingly, you know, perpetrating an abuse of power.
Oh, you're just a bunch of, you know, chemicals that needs to be aligned in the right way for the machine to function correctly.
Oh, totally. Oh, my God. I mean, the chemical thing was just, I mean, you know, it was literally forced down my throat. And because, you know, I didn't want to take anything, you know. All I needed, it was just clear, you know, the only thing I have is my own personal experience. But it was just clear to me that all I needed was like a container with space and time to just unfold my experience, to be supported. And it probably would have taken a few months. And then just in a natural way, you know, if somebody's having a real genuine awakening, just it becomes integrated. And any form of, like, if there's subtle inflation, you know, just in a natural way, just falls away. And then, you know, it's the whole thing about when somebody's called to be a shaman. The indigenous people understood, oh, at first they look, it looks like they're having a psychotic break, but they might be being called by the spirit. And, you know, and part of the shamanic, the whole process is a descent into the underworld. But if they're able to get through it and not get stuck and come out the other side, you know, archetypically, they have gifts for the tribe, for the community.
Yes, yes.
And that was all I needed, was just to be like having somebody have a recognition. But it was 30 years ago. It was like Stone Age compared to what it is now. And now it's incredibly bad still. But even then, I mean, it was just off the charts. You know, anybody having any sort of weird experience was just immediately pathologized and locked up and medicated.
Yeah, it's a very interesting idea here. Now,
and the so-called medications are actually the worst. The so-called antipsychotics.
Put me on an antipsychotic. This one thing that I just remember, they put me on an antipsychotic, and I remember thinking, because I'm an artist, I'm a really creative person, and I remember feeling, oh my God, this is an anti-creative.
Yeah.
Now, a little bit later, Seth, I want to ask you about if this is applicable to everybody. There is, you know, allegedly, then I want to run through this with you later, many different kinds of ailments and mental illnesses, if we can call it that, and if it's applicable in every situation, though, what we're talking about now. But in any regard, before we go there, this approach now then has been going for, I don't know, X amounts of years. You can enlighten us about that. But what do you see as the fruits of the approach that psychiatry has had to this problem for some time now? What's happening in society? What's the larger consequence of this?
The consequence of what? Exactly.
Of basically treating people like Paul the way they treated him. Now, when we're not letting in these experiences into society, and as Paul said, that we've shut out the voice,
you know,
here.
Heinrich, the thing was, in the 60s, there was obviously in America and around the world, there was a period of revolt, and it was also the period in which psychiatry itself became under question by the youth culture and that people, that was the period in which, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, that was the period in which, Thomas Sowers said that mental illness was a myth. He's mm-hmm. a psychiatrist. And that was the period in which the person that had the most influence on my understanding, Artie Lang, said that schizophrenics were really having spiritual experiences. So there was a kind of revolt against psychiatry among the people that were at the bottom, among the untouchables, which is unthinkable in psychiatric terms because they're supposed to be incapable of tying their shoelaces. And yet these were the people leading the revolt, the ones that were, in the psychiatric eyes, most sick. But what then happened was, I don't know if this is the question you're asking, but it's what happened on a broader level. In order to save itself, because psychiatry was, people were looking for other alternatives to mainstream psychiatry. They were going to social workers who were doing gestalt therapy and all kinds of other alternatives. They were losing business, and that's when they decided they would change their mode of operation, psychiatry, and they would accept, before that they did not accept financial contributions from the drug industry, mm-hmm. from the pharmaceutical industry. So a new phase began that was primarily fueled by this economic desire to make more money, and that became the age of the, what the psychiatrists call the age of the brain. And the myth then became that we have the solution to this problem because it's a brain disorder. Before that, it was a psychological disorder, they claimed. It was the same people that always end up on the bottom. It's like Jesus said, the last shall be first. Somehow the people that are the priesthood, because they're the ones that are psychiatrists saying, are you okay spiritually? Mm-hmm. They're the ones, when they say you're mentally ill, they're saying you're in spiritual health, or you're mentally healthy, you're in spiritual, you're in a state of spiritual well-being, or you're in a state of spiritual disease. There's something wrong with you. So they're the ones that decide what's real and what's mentally healthy. But once they married, in effect, the drug companies, the whole thing changed. But again, the people ended up at the bottom again were the ones rebelling, and they were the ones that were supposed to be the sickest again, and yet they were the ones, and still are, that are leading the rebellion against the psychiatric system. So that was the change. It became a mass production assembly line process in the late 80s and 90s, and they were letting people out of the hospitals, but there was more so the revolt that began to take place in the 60s and 70s was pretty much wiped out because the psychiatrists now had the multi-billion-dollar drug industry behind it, and so then the idea changed from to the person being schizophrenic, their explanation, and the solution became no kind of talk whatsoever, just putting them on psychiatric drugs, so-called antipsychotics. The propaganda has always been the schizophrenics. Thomas Zaz, who wrote The Myth of Mental Illness, the psychiatrist, said the schizophrenia was the sacred symbol of psychiatry. Well, now it's schizophrenics and bipolars. They've made it bigger. But those groups still are at the bottom, and those are the people that are having the most profound spiritual experiences. Mm. So the way it works out is we're still having the spiritual process of spiritual evolution crushed by the psychiatric priesthood,
yeah.
By giving people drugs that destroy their spiritual and creative abilities.
And what is the effect of that? Because, I mean, that's, to me, when I hear that, that's an incredible you know, sad state then that, that mankind collectively has ended up in when we're declining new input, as Paul put it. We're not, we've clenched these voices, so to speak, of getting new information, whether that's from God or from spirits or whatever the source actually is there. That can be debated, of course, but I see that there is a kind of a stagnation happening within society. Would you agree with that, Seth?
Yeah, in America, certainly.
Yeah, and if I could...
Well, just to say one thing, though, that in America, if Paul could... it's one of Paul's themes, too, but in America, for example, you have a somewhat belated revolt against the corporate rule in America, which is like a monarchy, an elite in Occupy Wall Street, but it doesn't have the spiritual fuel that it needs, and that's why I call for the mad pride movement to spiritualize the political revolt, and that I believe that if the people in the mental hospitals were to throw off their psychological and spiritual change, they could contribute to that revolt, and they could, because any revolt that's purely political does not have the power of a revolt that is spiritual and political.
Right. Paul, you want to comment on this too?
Yeah, well, sure. The thing that Seth just said, I really so am behind that too. I've actually created a term, spiritually informed political activism, that sort of cross-pollinates both a spiritual practitioner and a political activist, because I'm pointing out, because there are so many spiritual people who are really well-intentioned, but they're just like sitting in their room, you know, meditating or doing mantras, thinking, oh, if I get myself in order, then the whole, you know, all the outside world will reflect that, which is true on one level, except that they're not seeing that their inner process is manifesting synchronistically as the outer world. It's just like when you have a dream, the inner is the outer. And so the way to work on your inner process is to fully engage in the outer world. So there are spiritual people who just don't see that and are just caught in like this narcissistic bubble of wanting to work on themselves without fully participating in the world. And same, you know, similarly with political activists, a lot of them have the best intention, but they're reacting out of anger or hatred, or actually not recognizing the interconnectedness of those who they're like, you know, like reacting
sort of
against. And then they actually wind up becoming possessed by the very evil that they're fighting against. So I'm saying, just like what Seth was saying, that there has to be sort of a cross-pollination between the spiritual and the political. And just to answer your question, too, before, I mean, not only the psychiatry individual, because it's easy to forget that individual people are involved. A lot of these individual people, just their entire, like, lives are getting destroyed by psychiatry. And the culture and our society is just getting so impoverished by these people who are incredibly gifted, who are snapping out of the consensus reality spell, who actually might be having really deeper, like, visioning, connecting with the sacred imagination, with their dreaming power, that could bring in incredible gifts for all of us, helping all of us to wake up. And instead of being openly just, you know, honored and received and supported, on the contrary, they're pathologized and oppressed and suppressed and medicated and locked up. You know, it just gets back to that. It's really tragic, and it just helps having conversations like we are to maybe bring awareness into the larger field with reference to what's going on.
Definitely. Now, if we're going to take a break here in a little while, I know there are a few more things I want to get by here, Paul, since we have you with us in the first hour here only.
And sure.
One thing I wanted to ask about is, I guess, what the fix, if you will, some of the suggestions for this is, because is it a good idea to, let's say, let everybody out? I mean, is there a bigger problem than this? And it kind of goes to the heart of what I described a little bit earlier. There are many different kinds of mental illnesses, and now we've been kind of specifically talking about so-called schizophrenia, but there are many ill people out there in different regards. So what's the approach?
Sure. Let everybody out? You mean out of the institution?
Right, right.
Oh, yeah. Literally, you meant.
Right. Yeah. The thing is, what I would say to that, because, yeah, there are people who are really suffering and who are, you know, who have, like, you know, some sort of, like, are in dis-ease, you know, with themselves. They're they're not fully connected with their wholeness. And what I would say is even just bringing, having the awareness, you know, and bringing it out more into the world that there is a phenomena called spiritual awakening or emergence, and that to actually even create places where people, because so many people, because I'm in private practice in this way, so many people are just having these experiences, and in our culture there's no place to unfold them, to contain them, to support them. So to have actually some place where people can go, where instead of just being pathologized and concretized and all that, they can actually, you know, explore their, you know, their process, so that organically it'll just become integrated and metabolized and assimilated in a way that's very, you know, that it's just like this not in a fabricated force way, but is a very organic, like this natural process.
You know, Paul, I wonder what you think of this. One of my theories in the book is there's generally a taboo against the messianic. And even in the mental patients movement,
Yeah.
I mean, when I talk about the great awakenings, people could say, and it wasn't a taboo then. This was another period in life, that the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of God, is coming.
Right.
But
right.
Even within in the culture at large, to say that that is terrifying to people.
Right, right. Well, that, like I was trying to say before, that's almost always part of people's experience when they're spiritually awakening, because, and that involves some form of inflation, because all of a sudden you're snapping out of the egoic identity and you're connecting with the self, the higher personality, and almost always there's a tendency to just identify with that self, and that's the inflation. But what actually happens, if the person is supported, that in a natural way just falls away. Sort of like you have to have
the inflation, meaning the person saying, I'm Jesus, for example.
Right, I'm Jesus and you're not, because that's a typical experience that, of course, has a pathological aspect. What I'm saying is that if that person is just supported in that, in a very organic way, they'll begin to see, oh, I'm Jesus and so are you, we're all the Messiah. That's where all of a sudden the inflation, like one image that comes up, if you have like this a rocket ship, it has to have enough fuel to break the atmosphere of the Earth. In the same way, the inflation actually serves us, you know, as we identify with the self, to break out of the consensus spell. But then, just like that ship in outer space, you know, certain of the engines just fall off. That inflation, if it's just supported, and, you know, and they're given sort of like positive reflection, will just fall off, and then more and more people, you know, that person will have the realization, oh, well, it's not just that I'm Jesus, we're all Jesus. That's actually what's actually going on.
There's so many people within the mental patients liberation movement, within the Mad Pride movement, they themselves want to distance themselves from their experience of the kingdom of heaven on earth. I don't know what other way you can put it.
That's a big mistake. I mean, that in a way is what the whole process is fundamentally about.
Yeah.
Very interesting, gentlemen. Let's take a little break here in a little while. I know you're going to leave us, Paul, for this time. We're going to have you back in January, I think, because you're working on the follow-up that we talked about last time we had you with us, Watiko. Give us your website, Paul, and tell us about your titles, your books as well.
Sure. Okay, so the website, www.awakeninthedream.com. And I have my current book out. You'll see it right on the main page of the website. Watiko, the greatest epidemic sickness known to all of humanity. And that's only going to be available for another couple months. And then in about 3 months, I have a new book out, Dispelling Watiko, Breaking the Curse of Evil, that's coming out with a major publisher. And that'll be, like I said, that'll be out in 3 months. And, if you just go to the website, you'll see the current version, and you can order it through the website. And, you know, and what Watiko is, it's an indigenous term where they're really the people who are like the Native American people have been tracking this evil energy that's been informing whatever's happening in our world, both individually and collectively. So they had a name for it, Watiko, and it's totally relevant to what's playing out on the global stage right now.
All right. That's really good. AwakeningTheDream.com, Paul's website. And we're going to have you back again, as we mentioned, Paul. But I want to also talk about the main book here, obviously, that we've been talking about so far, Seth Farber's book, The Spiritual Gift of Madness, The Failure of Psychiatry and the Rise of the Mad Pride Movement. We're going to obviously continue talking about this much more in the second hour. But tell us now, Seth, where people can go to pick up a copy of the book, and give us your website and details as well for this.
Yeah, they can pick up a copy of the book on Amazon, through Amazon, or in America, I guess, I'll say Barnes & Noble in Europe, Barnes & Noble Bookstore. And my website has the various connect links to the places that could go to the Inner Traditions, also where they might be able to get advice on the what bookstores in Europe have. But probably the quickest is through Amazon. My website is www.sethhfarber.com.
All right, really good. We're going to have this all the links up here on redhouscreations.com. as well. Okay, we'll continue with you, Seth. Stay with us. And of course, thank you for this time, Paul. Great having you with us. Thank you for that. And I hope we can talk more soon now. Continues in hour two, discussing two journeys of the spiritual experience, the shamanic and the messianic, which can appear to have schizophrenic traits. He also talks about Jung's idea of Christification of many. Psychiatry has invented diseases. Together with Big Pharma, they benefit financially on selling drugs to people who don't really need it. Sign up for a membership and continue to listen. RedIceMembers.com. That's from where you can download, stream, and subscribe to our RSS feeds. And of course, we have much more for you. Video material, interviews, films, commentary, and music as well. And before we proceed, I also want to let you know that we have Kent Bain and Chris Milligan up next on 9/11 as a mass ritual. But we'll be right back with Seth Farber.